You're listening to the Irish Times Roisin Meets podcast.
Welcome back to Roisin Meets. My guest today is someone that I have admired for many years and I've seen her on stage a number of times. She's a wonderful and very unique performer and her name is Camille O'Sullivan. She's been treading the boards and singing her heart out in theatres around the world for many years now. And she's returning to the Gate Theatre with Shakespeare's The Rape of Lucretia, which is a show that she created with her musical partner, Fergal Murray, who is another very talented Irish person. I invited her in to talk to me about The Rape of Lucretia, which is going to be going on in the Gate. We talked about loads of other things. She lives with Aidan Gillen, the actor, and she has a 4.5-year-old daughter, Lila, who she makes amazing things for, like Ferris wheels that are motorised and giant gingerbread houses. Makes me feel very inadequate as a parent altogether. She's a great artist and a great woman, and I really enjoyed our chat. Camille O'Sullivan, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us.
Delighted to be here.
Always a pleasure to see you. Now, I'm going to read out something because somebody wrote something about you. I thought it was quite good. They said, Camille O'Sullivan is a massive enigma wrapped in a riddle, trapped inside the body of an enormously charismatic woman, a kind of schizophrenic half-French, half-Irish Protestant born in London, brought up in Passage West in Cork by Dennis, an Irish racing driver who grew up in England, and Marie Rose, a French artist from Bordeaux. Adding to her allure is that Camille possesses a particular penchant for black humour and blacker melancholy, and can on occasion belt out dark postmodern cabaret numbers on stage like some obsessed but gorgeous goddess from the Weimar Republic.
I love the propaganda.
I mean, honestly.
I don't know who writes this stuff, but I've got to thank them for that.
Seriously, that's a lot to live up to.
Well, I'll just let you, the own listeners, know there are propagandist photographs that I have done myself out there to lure people to the gigs. But here I am with no makeup, a Pogues, because I toured with them before.
Hoodie.
And I'm rehearsing, so everything goes, you know, I just kind of go into kind of like a low gear mode that I look like I've climbed out of a bush. But that is, it is funny. And I always feel, it's funny, I feel quite shy when I hear it, because what you are on stage is not necessarily what you are, you know, in your life. And you climb up on stage to become that creature that has wildness or madness. And then after the show, you go, oh my God, what did I just do? So it's lovely to hear it.
We were just talking about the fact that your partner is Aidan Gillen.
Yeah.
Gorgeous, lovely Aidan. Talented. Let's say he's very talented also. That's very important. Aidan Gillen. And that the people who you bring your daughter to the school and stuff, they know you as this no makeup hoodie person. And they went to see you.
They were like, oh no, now we see why he might be with you. Well, he does. I mean, to be honest, I think what is quite, I mean, I share something maybe out of being a Cork girl and sharing too much. The funniest thing was when I met him, I had never seen his stuff. I knew he was known, but I didn't know, I hadn't seen Love, Hate, Nothing, which was great because I would have messed it up. But I decided for a strange reason, I would never wear makeup in his company and I would never go to an extent to dress up that he's seen me on stage. He'd seen me loads of time. And I thought, you know, I'm at a stage now. This guy's just got to know that he's got an eccentric girlfriend and this is what it is. And it's really sweet because, you know, he actually said, you know, and I can't believe I'm showing this in a podcast. We went in Edinburgh, like, you know, those plastic kind of Rain Max older women wear.
Yeah.
They've got a kind of like you buy them. They're tiny. You put them over your head.
Yeah.
I love them. I have about 5 of them. I actually love them. There is actually one on Twitter at the moment for me before going for a photo shoot. Proudly, I'm displaying it. But I always remember we were on a bus and I was wearing this thing. I was doing the Edinburgh Fringe like my 12th year. And I'd gone up and I'd asked the bus driver, oh, do you take coppers? And Aidan says, that's basically it. That hat plus the coppers phrase. I said, that's it. He said, we're together now. So
you're the whole package.
Well, I just think it's funny is how much you try for so many years that you try to be something else, especially being a performer. And my actually thing is my life has lived so much on stage that I have to try and make sense of who I am when I'm not on it. So usually it's just being, you know, not that I'm going into the Patti Smith arena, but I think, you know, I love dressing up. Like I always love to be, you know, colours or beautiful hats or capes. You know, I was a big Bowie fan. And I think when he passed away, I thought I will dress up in honour of this man passing away. So I love that. But I do think there's an essence to you of like just trying not to
cover yourself too much, so you don't get mixed up too much with the performer on stage. So I do laugh sometimes. I think, like, when I sometimes to try and go out in the evening, it's too much my makeup because I'm doing it for, like, the stage. So I'm like, girlfriend's going, oh, I think you should back off on that winged eyeliner, Camille, and all that sparkle on your face.
And your daughter is 4.5.
Yep.
So how is that? What kind of a parent are you? Because I'm reading things about you making, Ferris wheels and flipping giant gingerbread houses and feeling quite inadequate.
No, don't feel inadequate. I have so many things I can't do at all right, and actually I'm a disaster at. I'm like quite a childlike person myself. And friends joke, they go, so she loves sparkle and she loves Dorothy, Wizard of Oz, and who would have made her like those things? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. And, she's been dressed as Dorothy every year for Halloween. I think I love the innocence. I love the kindness and the absolute, like, I'd forgotten what it was like. And I think sometimes going on stage is that's what you're trying to relive, is that complete kind of, like, joyfulness. And when, you know, she's so adorable, and at this age, the things that they love are looking at a tree, or I want to hug somebody, or I love you, mammy. You know, so I get great joy when I come off tour making stuff out of cardboard. But I think, I don't know if it's for her or for me, because to be honest, I've always wanted a gingerbread house. So I thought, there she is, she'll love that, I'll make one. And Narnia is really, I think, more so for me, the notion of getting like 20 white Christmas trees and making a bar for my friends. So, you know, she's going, is this for me? And I'm like, So I'm terrible at structure, and I'm probably not the best cook, but my intentions are to make her happy. And also, interestingly enough, not to lead her into this mad world I'm in. She, you know, her daddy is a musician, so am I. And, you know, she is quite a shy person, a bit like my mum. I think it's quite sweet. I saw her kind of performing around a school play, and she's the only child that didn't say anything and looked down at her shoes, and my mum and I were like, what's wrong? And then later on, she kind of recited it all to my dad by FaceTime. I said, why did you do it? She said, too many people. And I laughed, because even though I'm a performer, I understand that too, you know, that you're like, I love to sing, but maybe not when you're around. Sorry, these are very, you asked me a question, I'm so cork, I'm just rattling off, you know.
Do you know the way, every time I read something about you, the people say that you're eccentric, or that you describe yourself, would you just think that's a fair...
I think so. I'm very friendly, like I love a good chat. I'm probably shy about what I say, because, you know, you say something and then you're tripping over yourself. And I would never sing at a party. I've never, you know, who I am on stage is, like, all my friends, when they saw me, said, I don't know who that person is. I mean, you and I've met on very lovely times when it's been at a dinner party, or, you know, I suppose in the way that I'd see Prince as being eccentric, or Bowie as being eccentric.
I love that you're comparing yourself to Prince.
Well, I don't mean it. I don't mean that I'm like them. God, no.
But
I do admire them. So Tom Waits is eccentric. So I'm looking at those kind of worlds, and PJ Harvey, or people, you know, Picasso or whatever. I'm not saying I'm like them, but people that inspire me. And then, you know, great, you know, writers and stuff. I mean, many of the people you meet, like, everybody's got a facet to them. I think everybody has an eccentricity, but maybe I've allowed myself to follow that route more than others. Like, I did go down the route of being an architect, and I didn't follow it. I was like, up at that time in my business outfit on sites doing technical details. And I just went, you know what? I'm not great at reality. I'm pretty good at fantasy. I'm trying to live in a 1940 film all the time. I'm a bit of a dreamer, but I don't see it as someone who's bonkers. I think I came from a household of a father who was a racing driver, and who was a sailor, and, you know, a French mum who kind of traveled all over the world. So it's maybe the path that isn't always trodden. It's the one that I wanted to, and it took me a while to get there. And I think, yes, it's eccentric to have a Christmas tree for others that is there in March, maybe in the living room. But I'm like, that gives me great joy. So it's just taking, you know, it's looking at things in a different angle. And the same way that my stuff on stage, like, there's animal masks and a swing and vintage dresses with lights in them. It's more so, maybe children are eccentric. Maybe if you look at children and their little views, but they're not. They're the purest thing ever. And they say things and they make you gasp and you go, oh my God, that's such a brilliant way to look at something. And I realised maybe after Lila that I've started to look at things maybe too normally or something. So,
and you had a car crash and that was very sort of important in terms of what path you took. Can you tell us about that a bit?
I always think there is, I don't know if anybody looks back on what they've ended up doing and say, how did I get here? You know, and I think there was a definite moment in my life. There was Camille before the car accident and Camille after. And the car accident was when I was an architect working and teaching in university. And I still was trying to keep my paw in acting and singing. And my sister said to me, she never knew I wanted to be a singer until I had the accident. And she was like, do you want to check that she's okay in the head? What's she on about? And it was really, I think I'd always struggled with it, as many people do. Some people want to just do different things with their lives. And the accident just was quite bad. And I had to learn how to walk again. And all the injuries were kind of the back, my head and stuff. So you wouldn't see it, but using my hands again. So I was in recovery for quite a long time. And I remember the initial, and I'm sorry to go on about it because I don't want to belittle the accident, but it really was, I wouldn't wish it on anybody, but it was possibly the best thing that ever happened to me, because I don't think I would have had the courage to change. And the mixture of morphine and the feeling of absolute love for people in my life and the thankfulness to be alive, because I didn't even know if I could ever do things properly again. But I just woke up kind of going, oh God, I'm not important. I don't matter. And that was from a child, that was a big wake up call. And then I went, and you know, all the times you worry, Camille, about what people will say, that won't matter either, because you've got one chance now. So that was in my head. Little did the nurses or my parents looking at me know that was going on. And then I slowly went to them. I said, I think I want to sing. And also I made a decision. Anybody who'd hurt me, I needed to tell. Like, there was lots of things to be sewn up.
This was all while you were lying there.
Yeah.
Kind of not sure,
and I couldn't. I just said to myself, I need to tell people I love. I need to say it to them. I will never waste my time ever to tell anybody. Like, and I am a bit like that. And I thought, what the hell, you know, if those people matter, I don't want to be the last time. Now, that feeling does disappear as your body, you know, your back. I went to a nursing home. I had to live with old people, which was a fascinating thing. And then when I left that place, I had to live in a house and I couldn't go back to my mum and dad. So Fergal, who works with me and came to mind me, and he had to kind of take care of me. And I remember writing on the left, with my left hand on the wall, like I was watching kind of bad repeats of Falcon Crest, which were fascinating, like the styles. And I was like, this is amazing. That's all I missed during college. And I was like, this could be addictive. And I was writing like, I must sing Do Not Forget. And it was a very simple thing because I do think it's really, I think a lot of people, especially me, I would have put loads of obstacles up. I've qualified. My parents have spent this. I need enough money. I can't leave. I won't have the money. And it all became very clear. I don't care if you don't have the money. I don't care if they are nasty to you in reviews or, you know, you just need to try this out or you will never forgive yourself. And it reminded me of something my dad had said, just do it. And also somebody says, imagine yourself 80 when you write yourself going, did you ever bother to try and do those things? So I think your body is in such shell shock. You don't really care. So you're just really the most instinctual you'll ever be. And then as time comes back and you get normal again, then all the worries and the fears all get built up. So I sometimes, when I'm trying to make decisions in my life now and I get really nervous, I go, just try and remember that.
And when was that?
That would have been 2000. So
right,
now,
so nearly
from the moment now, that journey then was like very simple. Fergal, who was so kind, I said, I had done singing with other people, but I hadn't done it by myself. I said, I want to do this by myself. And my mum and dad were like, oh my God. My mother said, you are so sensitive. And she said, and also, you might not be that good. We are, Daddy and I think you're good, but who do we know? We're just your parents. So when they came, they were like, who are
Thank
these
God.
People? She doesn't say, you know, but I love my mother, you know, thinking the doubt. I was like,
And it's still to this day, they'd be like, well, we're
not sure.
So sure.
Not Irish.
No, no. But there's a lot of Irish in there. So, and I still have that. Like, I still go on every night, like, we're going to do this thing. It doesn't matter how much you play, you still go, oh God, you know. And Fergal was so sweet. He said, all right. I said, what does guitar and drums, like, you know, what do they do in a thing? He said, well, that's rhythm and that's melody. And I said, well, let's forget about that. Let's just use melody and piano. And it was just me and him in the Cobalt Cafe in North Great Georgia Street with Dorothy and Eddie. Lovely people. I used to go get pajamas from Penny's and stay overnight. I've always got on really well with venues. And it was simple and beautiful. And nobody other than Agnes Burnell and Jack Ellen and stuff, there was nobody really doing that type of music at that stage. And so when I tried to get a gig in Bewley's, they went, well, it's, you know, what's this stuff about? And can't you, you know, why don't you do this, this and this? So I was horrified. And your man and the
tell us about the stuff you were doing.
Well, I was doing kind of Kurt Vile and you're very inspired by Agnes Burnell, amazing singer. And it was about becoming, it was about, when I first heard Jacques Brel would have been through my mum, who's French, and my dad and mum are big fans. And then when I was in UCD, I auditioned for Trinity, which was kind of like not done thing. And I got a brilliant part in Jacques Brel's Alive and Well. And on that same year, I went to Berlin to work in an architect's office. So it all rounded off with seeing Agnes Burnell doing this Brel show, going to Berlin, seeing Kurt Vile shows there. And my dad, it was the first time he kind of, I knew something was up because he came 20 times to the show. My father never. He said, I didn't know you could sing. And my mum was.
But was he just entranced? He couldn't believe
it. Well, I wouldn't say. My father's harder than that. He's a great supporter, but I wouldn't say entranced, but he'd never say it to me. Okay. I'd know it from him being there. So that was
the fact that he was there 20 times.
Oh, no. And that was unbelievable. Yeah. I was like, something is definitely happening. And I knew something was happening too. I kind of went goodbye to my architectural career. But it would take another 7 years before I had the confidence. I loved it, but I still went, I don't know if I'm good enough or, you know. And so that was a kind of, that music was interesting because I was talking to Fergal the other day. I said, how did we end up doing the Roy Shakespeare Company with this? Or how did we end up doing Radiohead and Nick Cave? And it was actually my mum, who was so sweet, she said, I listened to you listening to David Bowie, Moon Age Daydream. Now, I think you need to put this in your set list. And I went, I like it. And she said, I don't dance to anything. And she also said, look, you know, somebody said to me, look at your record collection. So it turned out that everybody like Leonard Cohen, who everybody who speaks, sings in their own voice, Nick Cave, Tom Waits, Bowie, Pink Floyd, they're all the modern versions of what I was singing, but they're all in my record collection. I'd never listened to the other stuff. And also, and it was a big leap because you get a lot of people go, I loved what you did then. But if you got to be true to yourself. And so I just thought, I will sing Brel to the end of the days, but I haven't sung Brel in years. And I do rocky stuff. And it made sense. Like, and also reading their work, like Dylan and everybody, he was very inspired by Vile and Leonard Cohen by Brel. So all that world was that kind of almost inhabiting characters. They all do the same thing. Mm. And
that's really interesting.
It is really interesting. And, you know, even you talk to Cave, like his work is sublime. Like it's you can be that mercy seat. You can be that person or you can be that lost lover. And that's always my interest. So I feel kind of shy. Like I talk here with a bit of nervousness and when I'm on stage, the music can take over and you can become that person. So I'm not interested in being me, Camille. I like being that person. And therefore, that can lead you down very dark roads which make people uncomfortable, and it can bring you to joyful places and vulnerability and show that you're not perfect and show that there's that beautiful quote that is one of my favourite songs and verses. There's a crack in everything and that's how the light gets in, by Cohen. And I kind of think, what I like in music and what makes you uninhibited or frees me a little is that there is something, there is a darkness, there is a light, but there is this thing, melancholy can make you celebrate it or be cathartic.
Mm. Now tell me about this show, because this is something that's been with you for a long time that you created, wrote. Tell us about how it came about and the new iteration of it.
It was Elizabeth Freestone's idea. She's an amazing lady, and she saw me in Edinburgh do this show called The Dark Angel,
And that would have been 2010. And she wrote to me and she said, let's meet up in a hill in Latitude. I was doing a gig there, Latitude Festival in England. And she said, look, the Royal Shakespeare Company want these, they want people to submit works to them for them to see. So we went down to Clapham Junction, myself and Fergal and her, spent 10 days writing it. Luckily, I didn't know I was being auditioned at the end because I would have totally made a hames of it. Mm-hmm. And but I didn't know everybody there was the top of the RSC. And I was like, who are these people? Because I can be quite like innocent in that way. And when we had written a good 70% of that show, which we, Fergal and myself had, we didn't know we had it in us. Elizabeth knew it. Because I thought, how do you make a 400-year-old poem sing like it's something from today? And so we are always carers of lyric. Like, lyric to me is king, and that's what I'll argue to the death on, that I want a lyric to come out. So if you're dealing with Shakespeare, first of all, I thought it was all going to be in song. And then Ceci Berry, who's 95, who's the amazing woman who everybody goes to learn about Shakespeare, she said, I think you should act, Camille. And I said, are you crazy? In the RSC in Stratford? And she said, even more so for that reason. She said, you're going to bring something different as a singer. So credit to them, you know, because I'm not trained. We did that audition, and what I didn't realise was 40 companies from all over, like Knee-High, all the major companies had come, submitted, and two of us got the commission. And then it had to go further until it was commissioned, and then we created what is a beautiful lesser-known poem called The Rape of Lucrece. He wrote it when he was 28. It's about 2.5 hours. We whittled it down to 90 minutes about a story that is really contemporary about a woman and a man. I'd play several different roles. And what happens when evil is unleashed on good? And it's not just black and white, because what is brilliant about Shakespeare in this poem and what makes it different to anything he's ever done before, it's a woman's voice that comes to life. It's very rare in his pieces that a woman holds the whole poem and you get the workings of her mind. We set about trying to work out how, you know, this old language and music, how do you do it? So there was many things. We would have had themes for her and themes for him. And Fergal is amazing. We're like a river that runs. So we decided there's moments that speaking happens, music happens, and then a song begins. And a song, to make it really belong to the music and be real, there's a certain pattern to the royal rhyme of his poems. And so, for example, if you had a thing like Daughter, Dear Daughter, the song would be worked out from the rhythm of the opening line. So, Daughter, dear daughter, old Lucretius cries, that life was mine that thou hast here deprived. So you would take it from the melody and the natural rhythm. So that was the first thing. And then we thought, like Nick Cave stuff, I'll always, you know, I'm a terrible one for not being a singer. I feel embarrassed not. I'm not a singer-songwriter from Ireland, but I've realised what we do is we take people's stuff, like an actor taking, like many different actors have taken a Beckett piece or a Shakespeare piece and they make it their own. Whereas if you're a singer taking somebody else, they go, oh, it's a tribute or it's not your song, but you're going, that's not what I'm wanting to do here. What I'm trying to do is take that story and make you hear it in a way you believe it's mine and you never heard it before. So all those years of thinking, what the hell have we been doing? We sat there going, do you know, maybe we do know. And so we thought, well, what if, you know, whenever we do Cave, we always just break it down to really simple hymnal, because his stuff is quite religious, and take the music so it's not too busy and then you hear the lyric. And then other things where it's madness, and that's where you bring a bit of, you know, we go like, that's Rolling Stones or rock and roll, you know.
I'm interested that it's going to be in the Gate, and a lot has been happening with the Gate and allegations against Michael Colgan and those kind of things. Yeah. And you would have worked there and Sweeney Todd and all those kind of things. What was your take on all of those things that have happened?
To be honest, I tend to keep out of that stuff in the public eye. I have, you know, I think it's a big honour for me to be there. I had an amazing run there before. I had my own situation happen, and I think that's kind of a, that's, you know, I'm the kind of person that I will be private about that. I feel, in a sense, for Selena, I'm a big fan of Selena Cartmell. I'm a big fan for what the Gay Theatre does. And what I don't want it to do is injure what they're trying to do, because she is, I mean, there's somebody I worked with Sweeney Todd with her on it. I have very happy memories of my time working with Anita Reeves, who was one of, and a dear friend and one of the most gorgeous people I knew there. So it's a funny thing. I think things happen in work. I do think people have to be accounted for if they have gone through problems. It's how you handle that. I think it's important the discussion is out there. But I think it's this new life that's happening there has to be, I think they need support, really, instead of being, I think what would scare me is if all this publicity would tarnish their name, do you know? And also, there's so much good work that's been done in 33 years. I mean, the most phenomenal stuff I've ever seen. And what she's trying to do now is a new thing. So I think there's a new door there. And I also, Selena has been incredible. Every step of the way, she minds us and kind of goes, are you happy? Are you okay? She's very aware. She's an actor's director and person and friend. She's very aware to kind of go, are you all satisfied? She's a very equal person. So I think it's important that it's gone out there. I think it's very important because actors are vulnerable. Very vulnerable. I don't think many people understand that. A lot of people go, I should get another job. But Dublin is only the Abbey and the Gate and many other great places. But if you can't get a gig there, or if you speak up, that's pretty much it. So it helps that sometimes doors are open to have discussions like this. And that, you know, I realised very early on, I'm in a bit of a better position as a singer. I can walk away from things and I can say things, but I think actors and actresses are vulnerable.
So people have seen you in the Spiegel tent or in various guises.
They're going to wonder what the hell's that about.
You've been all over the world. You've done so many different things. I mean, that idea that maybe you wouldn't succeed, but you're going to do it anyway. You did succeed. You've had it's been your living. You've been able to make very hard work and very, you know, you've been very tenacious.
CDs
about it.
Under the bed, you know, haul them out. Exactly. Cash going, are you going to sell those things tonight?
Talking about people now who maybe haven't been to see you or people who have, why should they go and see this in the Gate?
Well, there's different. I would look, I mean, we had a thing that happened recently, which was kind of I kind of pinch myself because I am a doubter. I am someone who goes, oh my God, what's happening? My sister said, Camille, it's okay. Listen, you still have a living in it. And I do think people are surprised if they saw you in something years ago, they might go, that's very different. But, that's where we have travelled quite a lot. I mean, we've had everybody from 15 to 80 come to this and everybody has a question after it. Like when we've had talks about it, it's really beautiful to see. I'm all about emotion and that's what I get my thing from, and vulnerability on stage. And I'm not going to get up there unless, like, I'll be hard on myself. I go, oh God, I don't know if I was good enough or whatever. Like, I get up there to try and make that an evening to entertain and to give Shakespeare, who's amazing, his justice. And really, like I was saying to Elizabeth, I think having great affection for anybody who comes to see our baby and what we created, I think it's a beautiful story. And I think it's the music, like Fergal's music, like it's a very new, lovely new way to hear Shakespeare. Mm-hmm.
We started by talking about Aidan Gillen, your partner, and all that.
Sure, you can see her face. The blood drains from her face.
But, you went...
Or his face. What was she going to say?
Your daughter's father's Mike Scott musician as well, as you mentioned. And that, relationship ending and all those kind of things. I mean, you've been through a bit of a mill, as many people have, with relationships.
You get to be a better singer, I've discovered.
Yeah, tell me about that. What's the impact of it?
The more disasters, and I've had plenty in your life, the better singer you become.
So that was one good output.
This took 5 years. We haven't done this. I did this when I was pregnant, which was one of the best times I ever sang on stage. But I had to relearn this piece 4 pages a day recently. Everybody thinks you're like some weird cultish person reciting by yourself in a park going, don't go near that mad woman. But my director said, Cam, you've changed. You're softer and you're kinder on yourself and you're not so so I do think all these, and I thought, oh Jesus, am I going to have to go through more heartache in my life to understand this music? But I think what happens is when you, like, if you sing a beautiful song like Ship Song or Are You the One, your little bit of vulnerability or fragility is what you pull in, not your strength. It pulls in kind of you going, there's a thing or a question in you, an unsurety, and you sing that to yourself. And most people, you know, when you go through madness, you are fragile, you don't understand. So it's the, you know, yes, it's great when you're sorted and you do the great indie shoes and you're like, whoa, but those are all things that I realized to be strong on stage is to be open in a fragile way. You can be fierce and angry, but you still need that thing, that charge. And so maybe when you go through things in your own life, and I would never say I've learned anything because I still make aims of it, but good humor, affection, and I would say, for example, I'm not a person who likes fakery, so even when I do my music shows, if I'm having a down day, I bring it with me on stage. I don't go like have a breakdown in front of people, but I bring that. If it's melancholy, I bring it, or if I'm happier, I bring it. You go through those things and you know, march on. And I think having Lila is also, sometimes it's really nice to, like, I bring people on stage and my thoughts, whatever, and I think of her and her lovely little smile and not knowing if Mammy's a good or bad singer or, you know, all those things that are great. And you sometimes are singing and just thinking of them and, you know, so all those little things, you know.
Well, this is a nice note to end on, little Lila. Would you like her to be on the stage?
Oh, I don't know if I'll. I think I'm almost like, don't put your daughter. I think I'm the other way. I want her to be just happy. I just want her. Not saying, I think people mistake sometimes, you know, there's great joy from singing. It's a vocation. You're lured back like a crazy magnet. But happiness and her, you know, whatever she wants to do, you know, she can do it.
That was Camilla Sullivan there, and thank you very much to her. That's all we have time for this week. And just a reminder that you can catch Camille and The Rape of Lucretia at the Gate Theatre until the 7th of April. And I really would recommend that you all go and see it because, as I said at the beginning, she's such a unique artist and someone we should all be very proud of. Today's podcast was produced by Jennifer Ryan with JJ Vernon on sound. I'm Roisin Ingle, and I'll talk to you next time.